Let's start with our motivation for learning the Dharma. Practicing. So looking at our potential and our opportunity. So when I think about the precious human life, what I find most immediately striking is that the point about in every moment we have the possibility to change and to use the Dharma to the best of our ability. So knowing that every moment has potential to for us to use the Dharma, let's take time now to think about these really what seem like complicated topics in some ways as we review the material since last August, I think, is when we started this. So hopefully this will help our wisdom to grow and clear out our confusion and help us to be able to think very clearly and find the tools and the understanding to actually then be able to meditate on these topics and clear away our ignorance and see reality as it is and free ourselves from this house of cards of personal identity that creates continual confusion, separating ourselves from others and getting ourselves in all kinds of trouble. And as we wish this for ourselves, may we wish this for all beings, and also to have the fortitude to study this topic for a very long time so that we can really think about these things very clearly. And may this be of great benefit to all beings. So I think most people have this quiz from Venerable Children, and we're going to go over it in 4 weeks, so I'm going through the first bit here tonight. We'll try to get through the material that ends right before the where it talks about the seven facsimiles. So just to give people a reference. And it starts with this question, do you know what the seven different types of cognizers are? So I will ask you that in a moment. But they take mind and awareness and they split it into 7, 3, and 2-fold divisions. And so my question always is what are we dividing up? So this is where it feels a little bit, maybe you remember Cheechen Chong. And they said, do you want to sit in the waiting room or wait in the sitting room? When we talk about mind and awareness, it gets a little bit like that. So Venerable said, okay, a knower is the definition of mind. And if somebody says, what's a mind? You say a knower. And if they say, what's a knower? You say a mind. So it's like that. So really this topic, mind, awareness, and consciousness, these are all synonyms, which is actually different from mutually inclusive, I learned recently reading Jeffrey Hopkins. But at any rate, they're synonyms. And so what we do, I think, with this topic is we actually, as Venerable said once, you're taking like the mind and you're splitting it up like a pie in all these different ways. And what I think it kind of does is we keep splitting up in different ways and looking at it from these different viewpoints as we start to understand what the mind is. So mind is a knower. What's a knower? Well, a mind, but actually Jeffrey said a little more than that. He said a knower, a mind is a knower of the mere entity of an object. And the word is Rigpa, which is different from how Dzogchen uses that word. So then I thought, well, I'll just, now that we have some books that we can do the search function with, I looked up knower. It was interesting. So afflictions in general are defined as knowers that, when generated, cause the mental continuum to be very unpeaceful. So afflictions, in a way, are like mental factors. Mental factors and mind are two parts of the same entity. They're different, but they're one entity. And then Nagarjuna said, a knower realizes an object known. Without an object known, there is no knower. And he's responding to the mind-only people who don't really assert external objects there. But what that made me then think about is, well, what's happening when you're sleeping? And then I happened to run across this thing that the mind abides in two ways, manifest and dormant. It does not have to be manifest at to be manifest all the time, but can be generated from a dormant state immediately upon meeting an object. So that was interesting, although there wasn't too much more about it. That's in that book you have right down there, page 140. The Mind in Tibetan Buddhism talks about that. But they didn't say too much more that I recall. But this thing about deep sleep, when we... they were talking about the mental consciousness. This was in Cutting Through Appearances, and they said that the mental consciousness, unlike the other five consciousnesses, the sense ones, functions even in deep sleep and in the meditative absorption of cessation. So that kind of goes back to this, what, if you don't know an object, you don't have a mind, you don't have a knower. You know, so there's, like, my question to myself was, there's always got to be an object then. So I was wondering what happened when you're in deep sleep. And they're saying here that the mental consciousness functions even then, as well as in meditative absorption of cessation. So I guess it's interesting to me. So the consciousness is that which is clear and knowing, or luminous and aware. So this is the what we're splitting up here into 7, 3, and 2 types of pies. Okay, so... who can list the 7 different types of cognizers in the order that we were taught them?
Knowers.
The question was cognizers. Which could be knowers? Anyone want to take a stab at it? Okay.
Direct perceiver.
Direct perceiver.
Inference.
Subsequent cognizer.
Correct assumer.
Inattentive perceivers.
Doubt. Wrong consciousness.
Okay. Now, I'm going to give the definition, and you tell me what I'm describing. A knower which realizes that which has already been realized is the definition of...
Subsequent cognizer.
Bing! Very good. I should bring a pencil with me. Okay. A determinative knower, which, depending on its basis, a correct sign... is incontrovertible with regard to its object of comprehension and obscure phenomena, is the definition of?
Inferential cognizer.
Bing! Let's do. Does this make sense to you? Good. Okay, that's good. Okay, here we go. An unmistaken knower that is free from conceptuality is the definition of
direct perceiver.
3 for 3. Okay. A knower that does not get at an object with respect to which superimpositions have been eliminated, although it adheres one pointedly to the phenomena, which is its principal object of engagement, is the definition of
correct assumer.
It does not get at the object with respect to which superimpositions have been eliminated, although it adheres one pointedly to the phenomena. So it's assuming it, but it hasn't eliminated all the... I'm not going to go into most of these very much because this is what's coming up. I'm just going to touch on some of these so I don't, you know, make problems for the people doing the next weeks. Okay, let's see, what else do we have? Okay, a knower which is mistaken with regard to its engaged object is the definition of
wrong consciousness.
Right. A knower to which the specifically characterized phenomena that it is its engaged object clearly appears, but which is unable to induce ascertainment with respect to it is?
Intentive perceiver.
Very good. A knower which by its own power has qualms in two directions is the definition of
doubt.
Okay, 100%. You pass. Okay. So direct perceiver is an unmistaken knower that is free from conceptuality. That's the one. We'll focus more on that tonight because that's kind of what this section of the quiz is more about. So this unmistaken, we have to remember here that we're in the Satantrika school, and there it's unmistaken in terms of its appearing in observed objects. So there's no erroneous element in what's appearing to the consciousness. Good. But what is a directly perceiving reliable cognizer? Directly perceiving reliable cognizer. So now it's new. It has four things, remember? New, incontrovertible, unmistaken, knower that's free from conceptuality. It has to have all those four things. New was this, in the Satantrika system, that's how it became reliable for them. Pra and prama. Pramana is that first moment of mind. It realizes an object by its own power, but not through the force of a previous reliable cognizer. But that isn't the same for the prasangika. An incontrovertible means undeceived. It's eliminated the superimpositions, so it's really realized this object. So those four things.
So it's a reliable...
A directly perceiving reliable cognizer has those four aspects: new, incontrovertible, unmistaken, and free from conception.
Okay.
Remember we talked about the first moment of seeing something that had the power of its own, it came from its own power, not seeing it from the preceding moment of mind. And this is where they talked about. What was that? I think I'm thinking about something else. So sometimes she'll say prime cognizer for that, or ideal cognizer. So it's usually the first moment that you're seeing something. The consciousness is seeing it by its own power. That's for the Satantrikas. And we'll kind of focus more on them, not to get too lost. Okay, now we're going to go into a little interesting topic. We'll see how it goes. The next question. What are the three parts of a syllogism?
Subject.
Predicate.
Reason.
Okay. Some of the syllogisms that we discussed were sound is impermanent because it's the product of causes. We also did one, I can't understand because the words are so complicated. We did the person, me, I'm empty of true existence because I'm a dependent arising. And we also did all phenomena of samsara and nirvana are empty because they're dependent arising. Okay, so we're going to take one of these apart. The self is impermanent because it's the product of causes. Okay, the self is impermanent because it's the product of causes. What's the subject?
Self.
What's the predicate? Actually, it's impermanent, not is, just impermanent. Impermanent. She said is impermanent, but I've been reading some stuff on this, which I'll get into here in a little bit. What's the reason? Because it's the product of causes, right? What's the thesis?
Self is impermanent.
The self is impermanent. It's a thesis because this is what you're trying to prove. Here's the syllogism again. The self is impermanent because it's the product of causes. And so the self is the subject. The self is impermanent is the thesis. This is kind of what you're trying to prove. And you're proving it with the reason that you've already kind of established in your mind. It's the product of causes. So what is the presence of the reason in the subject? The self is a product of causes. This is the presence of the reason in the subject. The self is. This is kind of important. The self is the product of causes. And I'll explain this a little bit. It's more than what we did, but I found this helpful, all this stuff. So We're taking a little detour. What's the pervasion?
Product of causes, it is necessarily impermanent.
Very good. Whatever is the product of causes is impermanent or is necessarily impermanent. What's the counter-pervasion?
It is not impermanent. It cannot be a product of causes.
Right. If it's not impermanent, it's not the product of causes. I can't do this like you guys do without thinking it out and writing it out. When we did this and you guys just did it from your heads, I was like, you guys are something. I can't do that. Okay, so here's the thing that got me kind of going on this from some stuff I had read previously. So she said, Venerable said to us, okay, you know the parts and they make sense, but are you moved? No, we're not moved. So this is why I want to get into this topic a little more. So Daniel Perdue, who wrote the book Debate, has this article that I found on the web. You can Google it and find it. It's called The Tibetan Buddhist Syllogistic Form. And he explains this, and I'm going to go through it until I get lost. The subject sound is an impermanent phenomenon because it's a product. So the subject is sound. The predicate to be proven is impermanent phenomena, because we're trying to prove that sound is an impermanent phenomenon. And the reason, which is also the same thing as mutually inclusive with sign, so you have to get used to that, reason and sign, is product. So that little review, right? Okay. When we choose a subject, anything that is existent or non-existent can be stated, or when we choose a subject, the predicate to be proven, you know, the predicate, or the sign, or the reason, all three parts, you can choose anything, existent or non-existent. This is the rules of the game here. Okay, you can choose anything. But when you here's some things about the subject. So the subject is the basis with respect to you're trying to learn something about it. You're trying to learn something about sound. Sound is impermanent. Okay, so in the syllogism, the sound is something you're trying to, you're seeking to know something about it. And the one who is seeking to know, there's someone who's seeking to know about that. They're trying to know if it's permanent, if it's impermanent, right? That's the thesis. Is it impermanent? So for a proper subject in a syllogism in this tradition of debate, they has to meet two requirements. And the first is basically a form thing, that the subject has to be the first thing. The subject must be held as the basis of debate. So it's the subject, and so it occupies the first position in the syllogism. Like, so it's at the beginning, okay? But the second part is the part that I think has to do more with this. Why does this move us or not? There must be a person who has ascertained that sound is a product and is engaged in one can know whether or not it's an impermanent phenomena. You're trying to prove something to yourself. You've kind of got half of it down. You get that it's a product, and you're trying to prove this other part to yourself. So you're actually engaged in it. And this whole thing, so they're into the reasoning process. They're not like asleep. They're not like not thinking about this. They're not someone who's actually already figured it out. They're actively, engaged in this. So that, I think, is quite important, or else it's like, who cares? So, so it's not valid for a Buddha or anyone who has already completed understanding it, who hasn't forgotten it, or someone who's unprepared. If you're not, like us maybe, who cares? We can say these words, but it's like, whatever. So, you have to be into it in that way. And then the part about the predicate to be proven, this here and this one is that, which is impermanent phenomena. That's what we're trying to prove here, right? We're trying to prove that with respect to the subject, sound. So anything can be stated as the predicate to be proven. Anything. But you could also say, you could say that it's a permanent phenomena. You can say that. You can say a syllogism that says that. You can state anything. So that's part of the rules here. You can state anything. Doesn't mean it's true. And that's where we'll get to this. So then the thesis, we've kind of gone through that sound is an impermanent phenomena. This is what we're trying to prove. And then the reason or the sign is that it's a product. It's a product. So anything that can be put as a sign may or may not be valid. And this is where, this is what it comes down to, in a sense, is what is a correct sign. Okay. And it's also not set in this, and this word, the reason or the sign, it's not really correct to say because of being a product. Because of being a product. You say just product. And the reason is because there's two kinds of these syllogism. One is, they call it copulative. You're using the word is versus exists. Like, sound is a product. Sound is impermanent. But fire isn't smoke. You know the one with the smoke and the fire? Smoke exists when there's fire. It's different from smoke is fire. So those are two different kinds of syllogisms. And sometimes when we get all mixed up with these, I think it's because we don't understand syllogisms well enough. And we also, there's a lot to it. I'm just going to state the stuff I could work out and understood. Okay, so you can say anything. You can, for any one of those three parts, the subject, the predicate, and the reason, you can put any existent or non-existent thing in there. But then you have to see how do they all hold up. So then this is why we have this thing of the presence of the reason and the subject, the forward pervasion and the counter pervasion, right? This is how you determine that something is a correct reason or sign. And so the definition of a correct sign is that which is of the three modes. And the three modes are, it has to be, there must be the presence of the reason or sign in the subject, the forward pervasion and the counter pervasion. And that's, once you get all those, boom, you kind of got it. So that's what makes it. So, for example, in our the correct sign in our syllogism is product. The subject sound is an impermanent phenomena because of being a product. And product is the sign, and it's a correct sign because it meets those criteria. So, yeah, so it's that thing. Sound is a product. It's that type of proof. So I don't think we can say that for the presence of the reason in the subject, that subject is that sign. That's how you would think of it. So in ours, it's sound is a product. And that works, right? If you had a different syllogism, like sound is impermanent because it's a flower. Well, sound isn't a flower. You'd have to be, is the reason in the subject? Sound is a flower. No. So now your sign doesn't work. So toss that out. You know, so you can put anything in them, but then they have to work. And then the forward pervasion. Now this is where there's kind of like, these are between the sign and the predicate. You're kind of looking at how they go. And so in the forward pervasion, it has to do with being the sign in a similar class. And that sounds funny, but we actually understand this quite well. So it goes like this. So in order for a sign to be the forward pervasion, it must exist in only the similar class. So in our syllogism, this means that product must exist only among impermanent phenomena. And so when we use the example, it's easier to understand what they're getting at here. So, yeah, product must exist only among impermanent phenomena. So they're kind of seeing what class of things is. And this is why when they get into the debate, and you know, I use the Venn diagrams, but when they're figuring out what's pervading what, and you know, what's mutually exclusive and all this and that, and how, you know, this is why we're doing this, because we're trying to discern how these things are in relationship to each other. So this is actually the heart of the definition of the forward pervasion, that the sign is ascertained as existing only in the similar class. Well, maybe we don't care so much about product, this, you know, about sound being a product and this and that. But when we get to things that some of the other syllogism, once we understand this, then we'll get to something more like some of the ones. For example, in the diamond slivers. So we've you know, heard Jeffrey talk about that. I forgot how he retranslated it. The diamond.
Vajra
nodes.
Chunks.
Vajra chunks and Vajra nodes. So there, they have, you know, if we use some of these things, the subjects, things, are not inherently produced. That's the reason. That's their thesis, actually. The subjects, things, are not inherently produced. And then they have a four-cornered proof. Because of not being produced from themselves, from naturally existent others, from both or causelessly. So, you know, when we get into this after a while, we see that when you can really put your mind in this, what you're doing is you're like, you're actually laying all the possibilities out on the table. You've got all the possibilities there, and you have to prove that to yourself. There's no other possibilities. And then you're going to refute all of them, and then you're going to have to accept the thesis there, right? That no inherent existent production can be realized. So why is this important? Because if we realize this, we're going to free ourselves from every kind of suffering. You know, and this is kind of how one way that they do it. So that's why this all matters, and it would have an effect on your mind once you really understand these things and can contemplate them deeply. But we have a lot of kind of like background to work out here to be able to do that. And before we finish this question, I just want to mention that we study in the Prasangika school. And Prasangika comes from this kind of consequences, right? It's a consequence school. And that's because they have this debate about how to go about this, you know, syllogisms or just these consequences. And so what they do is they have the idea that you can generate in the opponent's mind, you can get them to infer this thesis by just giving them a consequence. You give them unwanted consequences that contradict their position. You use their position and then you give the consequences to it. And so by doing this, you take a reason that they approve of, you take a pervasion that they approve of, and then you show them a consequence that just can't work. And they have to like, wow, I got to rethink this, you know. But they say this is for the opponent is intelligent and ready. So anyway, I think that's helpful to understand the bigger picture on this, rather than it's just the exercise of, you know, what's the subject, what's the thesis, what's the reason, you know, like why are we doing this?
And so what you just said, can I say this back? Mm-hmm. That by through the power of the absurdity of the consequence, if the mind is ready, it induces an inference into the way things actually exist. That's the thing.
It induces and here they said the thesis. The thesis you have to accept because you know, and so it makes your mind move with whatever they're dealing with there. I mean, they use this for many different I think there are many different syllogisms and topics that they use. I mean, we do this all the time, proving, you know, just in mundane things, you know. So there's a lot more about that, and I don't know, that's the extent of what I know that I could explain. Okay, so now we're going to something, yeah.
John,
okay.
I'm just going to read out one.
Great.
So he said, I learned today that in debate, the reason of one syllogism is often taken as the predicate of the next syllogism. So for instance, sound is a product because sound is impermanent because of being a product. And the next syllogism they would debate would be sound is a product because of being created.
So they build one syllogism, one reason?
One reason
on another and one syllogism on another.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Okay, now we're going on to a little thing where with more participation. Every time your mind is filled with attachment, craving, anger, jealousy, arrogance, resentment, envy, nostalgia, daydreaming, these are conceptual minds. Now, did you do your homework and look at them and see if they were accurate? Anyone who didn't do the homework, raise their hand. Okay, let's ask you guys. Because you guys already know. What good is it asking you? You already know. Okay. Is your mind accurate when you have nostalgia and daydreaming?
Accurate.
Well, what do you think? It's a conceptual mind. Would you agree, or do you think it's a direct perceiver?
Conceptual.
Okay, it's a conceptual mind. A daydream is not a direct perceiver, nor is nostalgia, because nostalgia is like a memory towards the past. A daydream is like a memory toward, or a conceptual mind towards the future. Okay, so are they accurate? I guess when I thought about this, I thought, wow, those are usually filled with some kind of attachment, like nostalgia, just the word. You look back, it looked so, it was so nice. Mm-hmm. You forgot that everything smelled. Or whatever you forgot, you know. Or like you think about daydreaming, I'm going to go on this vacation. You forget that you're going to get bit up by mosquitoes.
So the accuracy has to do with the conventionality of what's actually...
Is this the question as it's written?
I think that was John Paul's question on what
comes to mind to me is accurate. I thought about the four distortions mm-hmm. and our tendency to exaggerate mm-hmm. both into the positive and to the negative.
And I would say all my conceptual consciousnesses are inaccurate.
All yours are inaccurate, okay. Yeah.
To some level.
To some.
Yeah.
But inaccurate is not the same as mistaken. When we get into yeah. the whole thing about, you know, that we all look at things as being substantially existent, but whether they, you know, they still exist, they still function.
Right.
I mean, well, in that way, then all my nostalgia is accurate.
Sure.
You know? It functions.
It's accurate. It well, it's not always accurate, but at least, like, my memory of what happened might be correct.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, I could also be thinking, like, oh, I would be happy if this happened again, which isn't
mm-hmm.
usually true.
I had a question
yeah.
about...
Go ahead.
From all these erroneous consciousnesses because of the exaggerations and things like that, but when the daydreaming, I wasn't quite sure because it's a mind that's creating it, even though it's creating a reality that doesn't exist, like a story.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean like all fiction that's written in the world is an erroneous consciousness? I mean, doing it,
mm-hmm.
it is, yeah. even though you're consciously making this up, knowing that it's make-believe. You know, daydream. I couldn't attach yeah. wrong consciousness to that because it was like, even though it was non-existent, I wasn't exaggerating anything. Something I just conjure up as a story.
Yeah, well, I guess that I think that it depends how you're defining accurate here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, which is it's not so well defined mm-hmm. in this question. So we can, I took it to mean, do these things have ignorance in them? Do they have exaggeration? Do they have the four distortions? That's how that was my way of defining it. Anyone else have other ideas?
I thought about, you know, just do they recognize any object without elaboration?
Do they recognize any object without elaboration?
And by definition, they're elaborations, right?
Well, jealousy, arrogance, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so special. Resentment, I'm so angry, which is 99.9% off at that point. 90% when it's anger and 99% when it's resentment. Okay, so what is the difference between a conceptual mind that has attachment as one of the mental factors and a conceptual mind that has loving kindness as one of its mental factors? And can you differentiate them in your own mind? I thought about this one, but I'd like to hear from you first. Any takers? Or is it left to the person in the spot?
I'll stab it.
Okay.
Because the basis of the first conception is exaggerated, the object itself.
Yeah, but attachment is exaggerating.
Yes, it's exaggerating the object, so it's not seeing the object clearly at all. So the very foundation of the conception, the thing that's inducing it, is faulty.
Yeah, so it's a faulty conception because it's got exaggeration from the get-go.
Right. Whereas
for attachment.
Whereas loving kindness, as a the object of loving kindness is a suffering sentient being, which without elaboration we don't know that, but the very basis of the object itself.
The basis of the object in loving kindness is a suffering sentient being.
So it's not exaggerated.
Right.
Seems to me you're not grasping.
You're not grasping when you have loving kindness?
Yes, as opposed to attachment. You just automatically ding. Grasping.
It leads to clinging and grasping.
Everything else.
And so I think of it sometimes, you use that word sometimes, feeling tone of the mind. Mm-hmm. And there's, I think attachment is an unsettled mm-hmm. kind of agitation and a zingy, might be zingy, mm-hmm. which I don't think you have when, oh, of course I have to say, loving kindness is kind of rare mm-hmm. to experience actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I don't have a lot of basis of comparison. I have I have some very clear memories that I think can fall in that category, and they're rare. And so it was hard to, it was harder for me to bring up the feeling tone. But there was something that was much more peaceful and clear about it.
Yeah, experiences. It seems like one of the big differences in terms of feeling that in my mind is, when I have loving kindness, or when I think that I felt loving kindness, it doesn't have much to do with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And when the attachment's there, then it's like really like has yep. so much.
I had that exact same thought. The loving kindness doesn't have much to do with me, and the right. attachment is like you're just. I want.
Frankly, it doesn't have much to do with the object.
Yeah, it doesn't have much to do with the object. That's funny.
I also put that loving kindness, which I was interpreting as this wish for all sentient beings to have happiness and its causes, that the wish is in alignment with the reality of all sentient beings' deepest wishes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually a very good point, that the wish in loving kindness is in line with the deepest wish of every sentient being.
That's, some reason I put that as,
so that could be a not a that's not a wrong consciousness.
Right.
That's one conceptual mind that we have that we could say is not wrong. I would say. Okay, who can list the 5 omnipresent mental factors?
Attention,
which are actually. Depending on who's, it depends on who you're using.
Yeah.
Depends on who you're using. Okay,
yeah.
We'll go with attention, intention,
discrimination,
feeling,
and contact.
Okay, so feeling, we'll use here Geshe Sopa's definitions. They were so much easier. The mental factor of feeling experiences the object as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and. And Jeffrey emphasizes that these pleasure, pain, and neutrality are fruitions mm-hmm. in order to emphasize that all generation of pleasure, pain, and neutral feelings are the result of former actions. And then discrimination is what identifies the object by discerning its distinguishing characteristics. I'm using Geshe Sopa's instead of Jeffrey's because I have his typed out here and there. I can say them and you can understand them, but it will be more work.
Geshe Rapton's is quite clear on that one. Functions to distinguish, it is this and not that.
Functions to distinguish, discrimination functions to distinguish, that is, it is this and not that. And if you can speak, you can say it. Okay. Intention, this is one that... sometimes Jeffrey uses the word intention, attention. And this one, we'll first start with Jeffrey's on this one. It's a mental factor that, this is in contrast to mental engagement, which we might also call attention. In some translations they do. So this was a little confusing. Geshe Sopa calls mental engagement attention. Jeffrey calls intention, attention. Okay, so whatever. Intention, which is the one that is related to karma. Okay, that is a mental factor that moves and directs the mind that accompanies it to its object. It has the function of engaging the mind in virtuous, non-virtuous, and neutral. It's the most important of all mental factors because through its power, minds and mental factors engage an object like pieces of iron powerlessly moved by a magnet. And Geshe Sopa's more short and clear. The mental factor of intention or karma directs and propels the mind towards the object, moves the mind to become involved with that object. Just as a magnet moves a piece of nearby iron, intention moves the mind towards engagement with beneficial or harmful objects. And then the next one, mental engagement, he would say, Gashisopa would use the word attention, that focuses and stabilizes the mind on its object, not allowing it to move elsewhere. So that's kind of the discernment there. It's kind of more... So Jeffrey, you said that the intention, attention one, moves the mind to the object in general, whereas mental engagement directs it to a specific object. And then we have contact. And actually, I thought what Geshe Sopa wrote was really clarifying to me, because I found this confusing. So Jeffrey, let's start with Jeffrey and go start with the confusion. Contact distinguishes its object upon the aggregation of object, sense power, and mind as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral in accordance with subsequent feelings of pleasure, pain, or neutrality. Thus it has the function of serving as the basis for feeling. Since contact distinguishes its object as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, it serves as a cause for feelings of pleasure, pain, or neutrality. So I always got mixed up as what's really happening there. And once you read Geshe Sopa, you can go back and read Jeffrey and it makes sense. Geshe Sopa just says it shorter and clearer. The mental factor of contact acts to connect the three elements of a cognition, the object, the faculty, and the primary mind. This coming together of the three activates the sensory or mental faculty, so it becomes the basis for feeling pleasure, pain, or indifference. So contact makes the basis for this to happen. And Jeffrey is actually saying that, but it's just harder to understand what he's talking about until you, for me. Do you get the difference?
He's also saying with contact that it sort of identifies the, well, I think he used the words attractive, unattractive.
Yeah, distinguishes its object. Geshe Sopa is saying the same thing, because he say it activates, you know, he uses kind of different words and it makes you think that it's the basis of it activating these feelings.
Right. Like
feeling is the experience, and contact is the basis of that experience.
Right, but it sounds a little bit more neutral and says activates, almost like
right.
A neutral, like an agent that just sort of says, I'm going to open the door for you.
Right, yeah. So I think if we think of it as the basis and then the experience of pleasure, pain, that helped me a lot because I thought it was hard. Okay, now we're going on to the next question, which are what... So those were the five omnipresent mental factors.
Attention?
Yeah, mental engagement. Okay, what are the four possible ways that things can relate to each other? Okay, now this is where I got kind of confused in our presentation, so I'm going to show you my presentation, because I had read the book Debate about this. So in Debate, focused on an analysis of differences between two phenomena, the challenger asks the defender to identify how the two compare. And the defender will give one of four answers. They're mutually inclusive. Get it? Mutually inclusive? I'll explain them. There are three possibilities. There are four possibilities. They're mutually exclusive. So here's mutually inclusive. Whatever is P is Q. Whatever is P is Q. Whatever is Q is P. They pervade the same things. They're different things. The assumption is you're not. They're different. The analysis of differences. They're different things.
Like my tree's an animal.
Like, well, no, because it wouldn't work. That would be a different one. They all have to be like.
Oh, okay.
They all have to be.
My tree is one of those examples of that one.
Like that is my tree.
Okay.
And my
all that's aren't my tree though.
Well,
so like product and impermanent, I think might work. I didn't have time to find examples for all of them. So let's just learn the words. If it's P, it's Q. If it's Q, it's P. And they're different things. They're not the same thing. Okay. Now our next choice is there's three possibilities, which can happen in two ways. It looks like this. If something is P, there's something that's both P and Q. P, Q. Something is both there's a unidirectional pervasion. Whatever is P is necessarily Q. Whatever is P is definitely Q, necessarily Q. That's called a unidirectional pervasion. So there's some pervasion here. But vice versa isn't true. Whatever is Q isn't necessarily P, right? Because there's some Qs here that aren't part of P. And then something that is neither. So there's three possibilities. One, two, three. That's one way you could have three possibilities. Another way it could look like this. Okay, you see the difference? There's still three possibilities, but they're different. There's two ways they can be.
That's
helpful. So this one is something that is both P and Q exists, something that is P but not Q, and something that's Q that's not P. Well, in this particular example, there's nothing outside of it, by definition.
The fourth choice is
that comes up. There's okay, in debate, let's go back, because this is where it helps. In debate, focus on analysis of differences between two phenomena. The challenger asks the defender to identify how the two compare, and the defender will give one of four answers. They're mutually inclusive. There are three possibilities. There are four possibilities. This is the one Venable taught us. Or they're mutually exclusive. Those are the four. They're going to state one of those. Okay? So here's the four possibilities. Here, there's something that's both P and Q. There's something that is P but not Q. There's something that is a P that is not a Q. That one. There's something that's Q that's not a P. And there's something that's neither. So that's when you have, if there are four possibilities between two phenomena, all points of similarity and difference are exemplified. In this case, there is no pervasion between the two principles. There's no pervasion between the two principles. It means that they aren't like, kind of like this. They have an overlap, but there's no, yeah, right. That's how they say this. So that's the fourth, and then, or they could be mutually exclusive. The two circles do not overlap and do not have a common boundary of pervasion. And this was the example of permanent and impermanent. And I think the first one, actually, I think that might be right then, that this could be product and impermanent phenomena, or functioning thing. Product and functioning thing would be, yeah. All those, I think, fall into this one. Yeah, so these diagrams help me a lot. So then it comes down to that there's five ways that all things could be, which we just did in those. Okay?
All those ones, I guess we need examples. The way that the three ways and the four ways.
Right.
How that relates to anything.
Oh, it does when they when they go through their arguments.
Well, what about my kid's cat? What can that be?
Cats. Maitri.
Yeah.
But what about...
And you said the outside ones, and then it's...
But all Maitris are included in the category of cat.
Well, not all... This Maitri. This Maitri. Yeah, you have to... That's what we're defining there. But anyway, does that help or hurt?
It's good, though. It's very helpful.
Yeah, I didn't have time to give examples, but...
Yeah, the drawing's helpful.
Me too. Because I had read this three or four times, and I've drawn it out four times now. And it's taken this long to be able to... I felt like I could say it without screwing up. But I didn't have time to get examples.
Good job.
Okay, so that's how things relate. And before we run out of time...
So did that... But did that go with the one that we're...
What are the four possible ways that things can relate to each other?
It's synonymous, contradictory, one is this but not that, and one is that but not this.
Yeah, that's the one. That is actually a subset of how... That is this one, the four possibilities. Because it exemplifies all the possibilities. But it actually, the way I understand this, it doesn't take in the whole picture. Because it doesn't take into account things like this. You know, it doesn't have this, and it doesn't have the...
So there are five ways that...
There are actually, according to what I read, there are actually five possibilities. Of if you were, but, you know, you have to narrow it down to the way they're defining this. Yeah. I can't say much more than that.
Okay, thank you very
much. As much as I can say about that. Next. What is the path from wrong consciousness to direct perceiver of emptiness? Okay, where do you start?
Wrong
consciousness.
Consciousness.
And then?
You
hear teaching. And you get doubt. Well, which kind of doubt?
Yeah.
Doubt, not tending toward the fact or tending toward the wrong conclusion. Then?
Plain doubt.
Equal doubt.
Equal doubt.
Equal doubt. Then?
Doubt
tending toward the correct conclusion or doubt tending towards fact. Then? Correct assumption. Then?
Inference
through the power of the fact.
Right, inference through the power of the fact.
That's what Jeffrey has in his book. And then?
Is that the same as power of the reason?
No.
No,
I'd have to look it up.
Power of the...
I don't know. Could she? I don't think so.
Because I've had it verbatim in her notes, so I have to...
Yeah. Too. Actually, there were four types of these powers, and I'd have to look it up to be sure.
Well, power of authority and the...
But I don't remember all four. There were four, though. It's in Jeffrey Hopkins. Somebody wants to get the book. Okay, what's after the inference, though?
Then you keep meditating until serenity and insight are combined.
Yep, serenity and insight combined, and you get what?
First
you get a mental direct valid cognizer, and then a yogic direct valid cognizer. That's what Jeffrey says. Yeah. He has this, in Jeffrey's book, Meditation on Emptiness, towards the very back around page 701, I'm pretty sure it's page 701, there's a thing where it has this, and it has the little numbers on it, and this is what I took this from exactly.
Mental direct perception, like at the end?
First, mental direct valid cognizer, and then a... Lastly, a yogic direct valid cognizer is what he said, but we never talked about this.
No, but the way we learned about mental direct cognizers is that it comes at the end of a direct sense perception. That's all.
Right. Yeah, we had the sense perception of quick, but that was in a non-yogic direct perceiver. So this is a different. They've got the union of serenity and insight.
It's the only place you can have a mental direct perceiver in the South Tantric is before the yoga.
No, we have mental direct perceivers, but they're so quick that we don't, they're inattentive. But these aren't inattentive because they have the union of serenity and insight. So it leads them into a last, I guess. That's the best I understand it. Okay, now the three divisions of mind and awareness. This was actually in the root text. It says there are, there were the sevenfold division, which we did already. That was the very first question of the night. The three. Conceptual consciousness that takes a conceptual appearance as their apprehended object. Mm-hmm. That was one. Non-conceptual, unmistaken consciousness that take a specifically characterized phenomena as their apprehended object. And non-conceptual, mistaken consciousness that take a clearly appearing non-existent as their apprehended object. We spent no time on this.
Nope.
Very little. Okay, so let's think about that. If you took mind and awareness and cut the pie up, you'd have conceptual and non-conceptual. So you got those two there. But then they took the non-conceptual and they split that in two here. One was unmistaken and one was mistaken. And the unmistaken one took a specifically characterized phenomena as their apprehended object. And the mistaken one takes a clearly appearing non-existent as their apprehended object. That would be like seeing inherent everything as inherently existent. When your appearing object to a direct perception, like looking at this plant, you know, it's non-conceptual, it's mistaken, although that's the tantrika, that ruins the tantrika.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah,
that doesn't
I think
work
it's
there.
A mirage.
It has to be a mirage. A mirage would be a better example.
Yeah.
It's non-existent, but it's clearly appearing to you. Sort of, or like the scarecrow.
Yeah.
When you're seeing a scarecrow as a man. Because it's mistaken in that way. Yeah. That's one way they split it up.
And a non-mistaken, non-conceptual would be a direct perception.
Yeah. Like a direct perceiver. Yeah, that's right. We have this a non-conceptual, unmistaken consciousness is synonymous with direct perceiver. And the non-conceptual, mistaken consciousness was synonymous with wrong consciousness. Non-conceptual wrong consciousness. That's all exactly from the root text. Cut and paste. The twofold division is the last thing we'll get into here before, I think it was our last question. It was, what are the three divisions? But the three divisions of mind and awareness are into seven, into three, and into two. Mm-hmm. And Venerable actually talked about a number of them, but I took my material mostly from mind in Tibetan Buddhism, and they said that these twofold divisions, in their book, they talked about six of them, but there's more than six, and Venerable had another one. There was one of those six that we never talked about. And each of these are approaching the subject of consciousness from a different angle. So the first one was prime cognizers and non-prime cognizers. That's one way to split things up. And so for us, in the Sautantrika, we had only the first moments of direct perceivers, and inferential cognizers are prime cognizers, only the first moment. And all the later moments of those two, as well as all of the other of the group of seven, you know, all the doubt and the correct assumers and all that, all those are non-prime. So that's one way you could split it up, whether it was that fresh, new, either inferential or direct cognizer or not. And then another way to split things up was conceptual and non-conceptual. And this, again, is an exhaustive taking the whole pie of mind and awareness, and or knower, awareness and knowers is how they call it in that book. And splitting it. And so how are they splitting it? This time it's in the manner in which the consciousness gets at the object. Does it get at it through an image or not? Conceptual uses a conceptual appearance, non-conceptual doesn't. And so in that there's no statement as to correctness, newness, right, wrong, prime, non-prime, any of that. It's just, is it using conceptual image or not? How is it getting at it, at the object? And then mistaken and non-mistaken in their book was a little confusing, and then I thought, oh, it's exactly how we learned it in the Sautantrika, but it's still a little confusing to me. So I will read this and you can help me maybe to make sure I'm getting this right. Because we use that word mistaken and non-mistaken in different ways, and I sometimes can't get out of the Prasangika way of using it. So we need to think like, you know, and then I'm not sure what they wrote this book from in their view in that book, but when I reread it, it seemed like it matched exactly with the definition that we had from the Sautantrika. So we'll see what you guys think. This division is made in terms of the correctness or incorrectness of consciousness with respect to what appears to them, their appearing object, as opposed to their object of engagement. Thus, non-mistaken consciousness is a category which includes only correct non-conceptual consciousness or direct perceivers. That's exactly a Sautantrika thing. All conceptual consciousness are included within mistaken consciousnesses inasmuch as the image of the object they are comprehending appears to them to be the actual object. And so then we go, so that was what it said in mind in Tibetan Buddhism to explain that way of breaking it up. But then if you go back and just look at the definition of a direct perceiver from the Satantrika view, it seems to fit. A direct perceiver was an unmistaken knower that is free from conceptuality. That was the definition of it. So it fits that. And unmistaken there meant unmistaken in terms of its appearing an observed object. There's no erroneous element in what's appearing to the consciousness. That's where I get a little lost. Because, well, I guess then you're saying that the conceptual appearance is an erroneous element. Well, they're saying in the word unmistaken. It's hard for me to... The word erroneous gets... It's hard for me to put that together with that. I can't think enough like a Satantrika, I guess. It's that whole thing of whenever you have an appearing object, you've kind of lost some kind of... Well, they're saying it's erroneous.
Mistaken.
No, erroneous. It says for unmistaken, because for them the words are synonymous. Unmistaken, or mistaken and erroneous mean the same thing in Satantrika. That's where in Prasangika they mean different things. Okay, so that's one. Mistaken and non-mistaken. Then there's mental and sense consciousnesses. This, again, is an exhaustive division. A mistaken conceptual consciousness.
Because all conceptual consciousnesses are necessarily mistaken with regard to the appearing object, but they can still be, but they don't have to necessarily be wrong.
Well, this is what came from our, that footnote came from our handout. I find that kind of confusing. Yeah, that's exactly the thought that makes it confusing for me.
So, like, just that, let's say you have a true inference that sound is impermanent.
Well, no, now you're in a whole other thing because you're in an inference.
But
go ahead.
Inference is a conceptual
consciousness. Right.
So, therefore, it's mistaken but not wrong.
Well,
a true inference.
The word mistaken is used in different ways. And the word erroneous seems to be used in different ways, so I don't want to confuse the issue more. This is where sometimes I don't think I can say. Let's go back and see what they said, because to me the way this is worded is the same thing as discerning conceptual and non-conceptual, because it's all related to, well, maybe it doesn't. Let's read it again. Mistaken and non-mistaken. This division is made in terms of the correctness or incorrectness of consciousness with respect to what appears to them, their appearing object, as opposed to their object of engagement. So we're talking about the appearing object. Is mistaken or non-mistaken? The correctness or incorrectness. Thus, non-mistaken consciousness is a category which includes only correct, non-conceptual consciousness, direct perceivers. So that means anything that isn't a direct perceiver is mistaken in this way that they're defining this. And then when you go, which is, you know, what it is, and then they say all conceptual consciousnesses are included within mistaken consciousnesses inasmuch as the image of the object they are comprehending appears to them to be the actual object. So that's because the conceptual appearance you are thinking is the object, and it isn't, it's a conceptual appearance. And so in that way they're mistaken, and they use the word mistaken for that. That's how, and then that fits with our definition of a direct perceiver from the Satantrika view, an unmistaken knower that is free from conceptuality. And there they define unmistaken as it's unmistaken in terms of its appearing and observed objects. There's no erroneous element. Actually, it does. I think we worked it out. Yeah. Is everybody following it? Partly. Okay. 50%. Pretty good. On to the next. Maybe we'll get better with this one. We're almost done, but we're not quite there. Okay. Mental and sense consciousness. This, again, is an exhaustive division. So now we're describing whether the knower is one of the five sense consciousness, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or is it mental? And the difference now is on is of the basis. The sense consciousness is produced in dependence on the uncommon empowering condition, right? Which is a physical sense power. It's matter located within the sense organ, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, throughout the body. The mental consciousness is produced in dependence on a mental sense power, which is a former moment of consciousness. So the basis, it's a difference of the basis. So sense consciousness are non-conceptual. Mental consciousness can be conceptual or non-conceptual. And so, okay, which of the, in our group of seven, right, when we've split the mind up into seven, which one are non-conceptual mental consciousnesses? In our mental direct perceiver.
Apperception.
Yogic. Yep. Which are conceptual mental consciousnesses? Jack? Correct assumption.
Inferential.
Doubt. And so forth. So subsequent.
Let's see.
Wrong consciousness. Well, hard to say on some of those. They said and so forth. Because some, I think, can be both. So they said and so forth. Okay, and then we also have mind and mental factors. This is another way they split things up. So the primary mind, which we some just say mind, and then the secondary consciousness, which are mental factors. So we have five main minds, right? The sense perceivers and the five sense mental. How am I going to say that? Five sense consciousnesses and one mental consciousness. Those are all the main minds, primary minds. You often use the word mind for that, a primary mind. And then you have the consciousnesses that are secondary, which are mental factors. So a mind in this split, when you split it up this way, a mind is the knower of the mere entity of the object, whereas the mental factor is the knower which on the basis of observing that object engages in the object from the point of view of other features, such as function. So I think actually Geshe Sopa says that easier, but I don't know if I wrote it down. So mind and mental factors are different, but they're within the same entity. That's the whole thing with the flash, with the lights coming in. There's one light with these different lights coming into it, which Jeffrey talked about. Yeah.
Can we use one of your Venn diagrams to do mind and mental factors?
Actually, I think his thing was so amazing. I mean, when you think about, okay, you have a box. Not everybody heard this, but we're taking teachings with Jeffrey Hopkins, and we always use the thing of the main primary mind is the palm and the mental factors are the finger and they're all hand, you know. There's this idea that it's their consciousness. You know, you're taking the whole mind, right, and you're splitting it up into primary mind and secondary minds. Primary mind is the main mind, you know, these five sense consciousnesses and then the mental consciousness, and then the mental factors are all these other things like the omnipresent ones, the determining ones, the virtuous, the root afflictions, the secondary afflictions, the changeable ones. So they list 51 or whatever, 22, a lot, but it's not exhaustive. I mean, there's tons of them, most of our afflictions and all that. But then Jeffrey had this great, you know, so your hand is one thing, but it's got a palm and all these fingers. But that's the analogy kind of breaks down. His analogy that he gave us the other day was really quite useful in terms of looking at how your mind works. Say you have a box, right, in space, a box, and you shine all these lights in it, you have like the main mind. But when you put all these other, like I put a little light of my, all my different sense consciousness and my mental consciousness, you know, and then I'm shining a light of my omnipresent mental factors, and then I'm putting my little anger affliction in there and my little doubt affliction in there. What you get inside of that, what, is light. You don't actually discern them all, but they're all contributing to it. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, they all color each other. That's, I think, was the point he was saying. And say one is stronger, like when you're, say if you think about anger, because it's, you know, we meditate enough, we get to watch these things. Sometimes it's very small. And when all those lights are shining, it's just this little trickle. Sometimes it's quite strong, but it affects everything else in the box. Mm-hmm. And that's how it feels. You know, it so distorts your perception and all that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just the way your perception is so off then. This is why it's such a great analogy, because it mm-hmm. how it just colors everything. They all blend, but they're all contributing in different ways. Mm-hmm. So that's that. I think we finished everything. Oh, I might have missed one. Yeah, I did. Sorry. Well, I think we went over this. It was about direct perceivers.
Yeah,
we covered it in the other ones.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we're done.
Do you have handy how many different ways you could divide the mind in two?
Into two? Uh-huh. In this book, there were two, and Venerable added one more that we didn't have, which was correct and incorrect. And then there was one in that book that actually I want to read. I didn't even say it to you because we didn't talk about it, but it was really interesting. It was called Eliminative and Collective Engagers. You know, when we talk about, they separated sense consciousnesses from mental consciousnesses there.
Uh-huh.
And your sense consciousness kind of were additive in terms of how they were kind of perceiving things. I'm just really bastardizing it here because I didn't read it closely because I wasn't planning on presenting it, but I want to read this because I get so confused when they talk about how do you know this is a gong? Because it's a non-gong or something. You know, that whole thing about not
right.
non-cow and non-pot and non-gong. And I'm like, I'm not eliminating everything else when I see this gong. It doesn't feel like that to me. This kind of talks about that, I think, mm-hmm. how that works. And I'm like, for me, that's just like, I have no perception of that. So I'm just like, it's just so intellectual, like, can't even get there. But I thought this might help. Okay, you better dedicate. You can save your questions for next week for the poor person who has to answer them. Okay, so this was fun. So let's take this joy and let's give it away. And let's think about people who are not feeling joy right now, and may they have minds that are not weighed down. And may people be safe, and may they have all they need, the four requisites, and every condition to bring them every happiness permanently. And may we continue to study and laugh as we study these topics and enjoy learning all the way to full awakening. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.